vacuums. Yeah. So, yeah.
So do they have a robotic vacuum that can deal with dog messes, though? I've heard of the horror stories where the dog has an accident and the robot and heads out to do its routine and spreads that all over the house.
So that was my thought process as well. And the answer appears to be no. Because if they could deal with dog messes, it would be like worth $1 trillion tomorrow on a NASDAQ. And so, like, I think that maybe there should be a suggestion box for the next CES, you know, create a vacuum that could deal with dog messes. And we'll see, hopefully. It's a great note on that.
I want to just bring something very briefly.
Yeah.
The idea of picking fruit or picking berries.
Yeah.
Are we looking at a robot, just an arm, not like a humanoid thing, just the arm, connected to a machine that would be able to do that?
Yes.
How far away are we from being able to pick apples in a orchard? How far away?
Perfect. This is a great question. I'm going to take 30 seconds to address it because I almost forgot to mention this. So in terms of the progression of where robots are going, I think in 2 or 3 years, we're going to see hospitality robots, restaurant robots, retail robots. So retail robots that can fold your clothes, can deliver food to you, can maybe even potentially cook your food, but definitely can serve your food. Now, in terms of where the next stage is, I think is agricultural robots. Robots that can spray, you know, like the necessary, you know, materials, can pick the fruit, can, you know, manage the crops and stuff like that. And way after that, I think down the road, 5 to 10 years, maybe longer, we're going to see construction robots. So I think that's going to be the order how it gets rolled out, because robots are going to get rolled out in this order from the most ordered to the least ordered environments. So the most ordered environments are like a restaurant, even without humans, restaurants, you know, stores, stuff like that. And then the less ordered items will be like, you know, stuff to do with dirt. So like, you know, orchards, farms, stuff like that. And the least ordered environments will be like where construction equipment is. And that would be much further down the road. Because every increase in disorder in a robotic environment is exponentially difficult for robots. It's not like for us where it's linearly difficult. It's exponentially difficult for robots. But yes, I think we're going to see it because, you know, it's been like this Jetson-like dream for 20, 30, 50 years. But I think now finally we've kind of got the cheap software to do it, and we've also got the cheap enough hardware to do it. Like, I mean, the actuators, which is kind of the thing that actually connects robotic and limbs and make them move and stuff like that, previously, you know, it would be like $20,000-$30,000. But because China and Japan and Korea have been cranking so many industrial robots, which use basically the same actuators, they've become a lot cheaper. So you can build really cool robots for a reasonable price. Is it gonna be a robotic future in our homes? I don't know. That's a different question. But are they coming? Yes.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Stephen Fan.
No worries.
Just back from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And so much going on. We only really covered maybe half the topics you were hoping to, but.
This is the story with every single show. You get to cover maybe like a third, maybe like a quarter of what you really want to, and you just keep looking every single year, and they keep you coming back.
Awesome. Well, you'll be back with some other reports in the future.
Yeah.
Arch reports and stuff, so maybe you can pick up one of these topics from time to time and fill us in.
Synthesize.
Awesome. Thanks so much. It's looks like a brave new world of robots coming our way. And it's hard, you know, maybe, well, it does definitely sounds exciting. It definitely also sounds a little worrisome in the scope of jobs that could be eliminated. I'm thinking about agriculture and retail and other spaces. Anyway, that's a whole nother story that's a little too big for us to get into now. Thanks, Stephen, for being here.
Pleasure as always.
All right. Next up, we have an interview from Danny Nesradani with SFU's Sterling Whiting about presentation and performance.
Sanders Whiting is a specialist in voice and presentation skills, affiliated with the Center for Educational Excellence at Simon Fraser University. Sanders has been instrumental in supporting faculty, staff, and teaching assistants at SFU since 2014. Leveraging his diverse background as a professional actor, Sanders brings considerable knowledge and expertise to his practice. Over the next few months, Sanders Whiting will be hosting a series of workshops on voice and presentation skills at Simon Fraser University. CJSF was able to sit down with Sanders Whiting and speak on his development process for these workshops, as well as what he hopes SFU faculty and staff are able to take away from his teachings. Please take a listen. Today in studio, I am joined with Sanders Whiting. Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, the first thing I want to ask is if you could just give a brief overview of the sort of voice and speech instructing that you do here at SFU.
Sure. The category for what I do is called voice and presentation skills. They go together, of course, really well. And so what I focus on is how people use their voice to make this just the sound of their voice effective, and then also how they use text. That's usually what we mean by speech, is how are they using text. And there's a lot of things that fall into that category, two of them being enunciation or diction, and the other one being emphasis. And so those are two things that strongly affect text, for example. And the other things are how you are in your body, how comfortable a person is with gesture, whether they feel shaky or whether they feel grounded. So finding ways to ground people is really, it really nurtures their confidence. And so feelings of confidence is a huge thing. A lot of people feel nervous, and so I tend to help people reframe that in a way that makes them feel more empowered.
That empowerment aspect, that seems to be a big part of the work you do. How did you get involved in the first place?
My background is in theater, music, and education. So I'm a professional actor. I have been teaching for about 11, 12 years teaching. Started teaching singing and then got pulled into the voice and speech world. Somebody who I knew that held my current position at SFU, which is with the Center for Educational Excellence, she said, "I think you'd be the right person to take over my job." And I came in to SFU and started teaching people about voice and presentation skills. I've been doing that since 2014. Mm. And the training in theater, of course, naturally lends itself really well to teaching voice and presentation skills. I teach a lot of the things. I teach some very complicated, intense diction exercises that you learn if you would, say, work at a place like the Royal Shakespeare Company in England. I use top quality content in my workshops.
What would you say is the most rewarding thing when it comes to the work you do and the people that you help with vocal training?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I hate to use an overused word, empowering people. Mm-hmm. When you see somebody that came in and they're nervous and they know they always get nervous and their voice gets shaky and they discover how to overcome that, and they are often surprised that it's a lot easier than they think. Not that it doesn't take practice, but anytime you get to a job where when people leave the session, you can tell that they've got a new tool that they can confidently take forward. It's pretty pleasurable as a teacher.
Would you say when it comes to people developing their presentation skills and their vocal skills, are there any sort of pitfalls or misconceptions that you think people have regarding how they can improve those things?
Yeah, there's probably a few. One of the pitfalls is thinking that you're born with a particular type of voice and it's stuck that way. Our voices can do a huge variety of things. The voice we use is generally the voice that we're just habituated to, that we use, that we feel it's okay, it works. But people can do such a huge array of things with their voices. It doesn't matter what age they're at, they can always improve it, make it more powerful, get greater range. Another thing is that you need to put on a show, that people think, oh, I have to present, I have to put on a show. And an interesting thing that's come along, I think, with so many things on the our world, with everything's on video and YouTube and things like this, is we've got a really strong sense, sort of a sensory thing about people being full of baloney, right? And so I one great mentor that I got to work with, and all the courses I took with him were online. He's an American singing teacher and presentation skills teacher. And his videos originally were very slick, beautifully lit. And then I noticed one day he switched, and there was just a brick wall in the background. I think he was just using his phone. And this was about 10 years ago. And I was surprised at my feeling that I kind of trusted him more, because he took away the special lighting and all that stuff. Nothing wrong with that stuff. It's an art in itself. But realizing that people are enough, and that's a little phrase we use for actors a lot of the time. Actors are trying to be bigger than they are, to fill the shoes of Hamlet or somebody really famous. But actually, it's learning to ground yourself in a sense of just being who you are in your body. I am enough. It gives you a sense of authenticity. And you may have noticed that things have gone from being really splashy and hard sell, you know, like 10 years ago, to now people are really trying to appeal to you that I'm telling you the truth, that it's not fake news, right? And so just people relaxing and being themselves. And one of the things that they can counter this feeling of having to put on a performance is that you're really there to serve the people that you're talking to. Mm-hmm. And that changes your status. When you change your status to somebody that I'm here to help, I may not be perfect, but I'm here to help these people, it can change your feeling of how being in the room is. And so that, along with accepting who you are and then go, I'm here to help, I'll do whatever I can to help, that is usually a huge paradigm shift in people's heads, that going, oh, I could make a mistake up here, but I'm here to help people, so I'll keep going forward in a bolder way.
The way you described it there, it's so much more than just developing a skill to be utilized in a career or academic setting. There's a degree of learning to accept yourself.
Well, and that's what I think a lot of people want. If you're going to buy a car from somebody, you're hoping the person's authentic and real. And I think that's almost a kind of a new aesthetic that we have. If you hear somebody on a talk show, you want to hear who they are. You want to hear the real person. You'll see a lot more people exposing how vulnerable they are as people on talk shows and things. And it's kind of a new thing of people, in some ways, being allowed to be more human. And I think that's something that we really gravitate towards. And another way to call it is bringing the whole person into the room. Mm-hmm. I'm not just bringing a performer into the room. I'm bringing me with all my foibles. And it's interesting. It's even a technique some people use. They make a mistake early on purpose, so people can go, oh, you make mistakes too? Oh, I like you. I can identify with you. So I don't purposefully do that, but I don't try to make mistakes. But if I make one, people can see that, oh, you're a human being too, and it makes one much more relatable.
Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to ask you is, because this the workshops you're doing here at Simon Fraser University are sort of a series of ongoing workshops, and all of them sort of tackle different aspects of presentation and vocal skills. How did you develop that, and how did you choose, you know, which specific aspects of presentation giving to sort of focus in on for each person, or for each workshop in this case?
Well, I love that question, because when I first came to it, I was coming from the theater world, and I've worked a lot, and I've started getting back into it as an actor on big stages with lots of people, sometimes with, very often without a mic. Many stages don't have mics. And so I'm coming into the room with this feeling in my body, it should feel like this, it should be this presentation big thing, and realizing over time, that's not quite what people need. And what I would find through doing many workshops since 2014, I do from two to eight workshops a month, and then I do private sessions. And this is all for faculty or graduate students who teach or instructional staff that teach, right? It's got to be somebody. People can work with me as long as I'm doing something with them that has to do with teaching. And I lost my chain of thought there. Where was I? And so how did I develop these things? So it's people coming into the room and going, so what would you like to explore today? And people, if they've made an appointment, especially for a private appointment, they know exactly what they want to do. They'll go, oh, my voice, I stand up and it starts to get shaky. It never does that with my family, or things like that. And I say, oh, well, let's address stability in the voice. Most of what people come to me for are either voice problems. They feel that they don't know how to project. And projection's actually quite simple. You can teach people to do it fairly quickly. It's more a psychological shift. And then the other things are nervousness in their body, shaking, shaky voice, shaky hands, and really teaching them to ground themselves in their body. And then just feelings of nervousness, which they'd like to transform into feelings of confidence. So those are largely the things, vocal things, then how do you live in your body, how do you relax in your body, and how do you feel more confident? Those are the three major things that, and I get surveys after courses too, after workshops, and say, was that beneficial to you? The feedback is so useful, and say, what else might you like to explore? What else would you like to see? So that's how I determine what gets offered in a workshop.
The major last thing I want to ask you is if you can tell me what you hope the people that attend these workshops and that attend your instructional sessions, what do you hope their main takeaway is, you know, after just one of these workshops or sessions?
To be generous. That's the biggest thing. That's the biggest paradigm shift in one's head. It's not to outperform somebody. It's not to bamboozle somebody. It's to really be there to serve people. It will take away your nervousness and look at everything in presentation skills as generosity. Volume is generosity, making it so people can easily hear you. They don't have to lean in and try to read your lips because they can't hear things well enough. So anything like that. Volume, even pretending you're a little bit confident, instills confidence in your audience. So you can even fake that out of it as a form of generosity. I'm going to behave generously, so you'll buy into the things that I'm talking about. So I would say generosity and a bit of boldness.
All right. I believe that is all the time we have for this interview, but I want to thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me on these presentations that you have going on at the moment. Would you like to say any sort of last words on this workshop series or just the work you do at SFU for any faculty or students that may be listening?
Well, I'd like to encourage people that their voice is it represents them in a huge way. It's kind of like their signature. When you walk into a room, and to be generous with your voice, to be generous with the energy that you have, that reads really well. And for people in university transitioning into careers and things like that, going into a room with a generous boldness, people will like that. Not everybody will, but I would assume most people go, I can work with that, I'll hire that. And if you're faculty and you go into a room with a generous sort of happy boldness, students feel that. They feel attended to. They feel taken care of and that you're concerned about them. So, yeah, taking in this sort of concern for other people, I'd say that's the biggest message.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Danny.
Once again, you were listening to our conversation with Sanders Whiting, Teaching Enhancement Specialist at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. This piece would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Attention, women in science, technology, engineering, and math. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting on your journey, the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology is here to support you every step of the way. From mentorship programs to networking and skill-building events, we've got the tools and resources you need to succeed and thrive in STEM. Visit SCWIST.ca to learn more. That's SCWIST.ca. We can't wait to connect with you.
Hey, my name's Katie. You want some cool new music to listen to? Want to know about up-and-coming artists, albums, and more? Well, come hang with me every Tuesday from 12 to 1. Raccoon City's where I'll be. Hope to see you there.
Tune in every Tuesday at noon for Raccoon City. Now we have Peter R.H.
So, and April...
We had a number of things we're going to talk about, but tell us about April 1st.
April, she was one of, at times, there's only four of us, the two people that set up the UBC Anarchist Club 40 yeah. years ago, and it was me and this woman, April Page, who I was one time, I remember we had a long bus ride together, and that was it. But I've seen her three times since, had a few discussions. She may or may not be part of the shows in the future. Okay. And here's a statement from her. Anyway, this is her statement. I don't believe we do ourselves a favor by bowing down to the belief that one particular nation, any nation for that matter, is the most powerful nation in the world. This notion appears to me to originate in a fabricated glorification of the military industrial complex. While some celebrated dignitaries like President Biden, President Obama, and many of their forerunners have proclaimed that the United States is the most powerful nation in the world, it is now shown that China is the global leader in industrial manufacturing. And Russia recently demonstrated that it has the greatest non-nuclear weapons capacity with its arsenic long-range intercontinental ballistic missile. This weapon is claimed to, quote, streak to its target at 10 times the speed of sound, unquote, and to be, quote, immune to any missile defense system, unquote. So to me, these examples alone stand to derail the concept of, quote, the greatest national power on earth, unquote, at least within the current military industrial complex model. For those who hold even a nanoparticle common sense, it is obvious that every nation has both outstanding accomplishments as well as its embarrassing failures. If we could abandon domineering power games among nations, we could mobilize the saying, knowledge is power for everyone, and so uncover a wealth of power and security growing exponentially among the 8 billion strong population we are. This might require some cooperation, working together, or as children are taught to do on the Sesame Street TV program. Politicians could proudly share their legislative success with politicians in other regions, saying, this policy or this bill, which we reenacted, worked very successfully for our area, or why don't you give it a try? Or contrarily, we waste a lot of time, effort, and money developing this other plan, so don't waste your time on that one. And conversely, reserving governments could in turn cooperate in such interactions by proudly sharing their success while warning of the duds. Do you think such cooperation, sharing agreements are too idealistic? They are amplified already every moment in the provision of shared instructional videos of the internet. Human beings like to share what they are good at and to offer warnings against weaker actions. Leaderships from each nation can do the same thing. So that's a statement she made.
Yeah.
And I think that right now, with the threat of the tariffs on Canada from the president-elect Donald Trump. It's more America first, as in make America great again, because it's, you know, we're going to make sure we're going to trip you over or something. And I was wondering, Stephen, if you could maybe, in this time remaining, kind of talk about the likelihood of the tariffs or maybe so on, the pre-existing trade agreements that exist and so on this.
Yeah, so I think just a few quick points. I think, first of all, you know, Canada has, and the United States, and to some extent Mexico, have signed a series of trade agreements, most famously NAFTA of 94, and which has been updated to USMCA during the first Trump term. So the integrated economic structure has always existed. I think the difficulty in looking at this from the Canadian perspective is that it is an all-consuming question and even obsession for us, but it is not a huge deal for the Americans. It's not a huge question for the Americans. Now, if a trade is actually disrupted across borders because of tightly integrated supply chains and stuff like that, it will become a huge deal. If we cut off electricity supply, it'll be a huge deal. But if you go, like, you know, I was recently in the United States, obviously, but, like, if you go anywhere in the United States, it doesn't matter if you're in rural Washington State or in New York City, like, 90% of the political conversation normal people have is about stuff like, you know, public order, crime, and to some extent right now the wildfires in L.A., and then, you know, stuff like border security, immigration. Like, the word Canada and trade simply just does not – it's just not on the radar. And I think that's part of the huge challenge in having this conversation from the Canadian side, is that for us it's a huge deal. For normal Americans, they just don't care. And they don't really have any reason to care right now until their lives get disrupted. And I think, you know, I think a misguided political strategy in Canada, at least among, you know, some people, is to try and get Americans to care. Well, you might get them to care, but they will be annoyed. You know, it's better if you just don't get to that point. My own view is that, you know, the moment Trump takes office, there's going to be so many different things that Canada is going to seem, and trade, North American trade, is going to seem like an absolutely minuscule concern to him. There are no real problems. He's picking on imaginary problems, right? All the theoretical problems they had were fixed last time anyways. They have exactly the auto sector they want. They have a bunch of manufacturing and service sector integrations they want. There's nothing they could change that would make them happy. They're just looking for an issue in the weird several sort of lame duck month after the election and before inauguration, where they could have a risk-free bet and just pick a risk-free issue to go on Fox News about. I don't think that's what's going to happen the moment he's president. He's going to have real issues, issues like the Middle East, issues like, to some extent, and this is something right-wing radio jocks care a lot about, you know, the southern border, issues like a ton, you know, various things.
If I could just interject here. If he's planning to go ahead with the tariffs, what would be the timeline of this happening?
If he's planning to go ahead with the tariffs, first of all, they'll almost certainly get stopped by the courts. So, you know, there will be a bunch of legal challenges, and most of the supposed tariffs will get stopped by the courts. So that's – he doesn't have completely unilateral authority on this. The president has a lot of authority over trade, but it's not unlimited.
So we're not talking about it immediately happening. We're
at least 3 or 4 months away, at least.
Okay.
We have just a minute left. I have a quick question. Do these court challenges, are they coming out of the signed agreements between three countries?
So the agreement itself has a dispute resettlement mechanism, and Canada actually insisted very strongly on this, knowing that it was dealing with Trump last time, and it turns out this time as well. So that has a fairly fairly neutral process,
right?
And so it's not. I mean, he can impose tariffs at the end of the day on U.S. authority. But, like, I think, you know, because this is all we see, this is what we're focused on, but I don't think this is what the Americans are focused on. So I don't think it's going to happen immediately. If it happens immediately, I don't think, you know, they're going to have the political temerity or will to go through with all the ill effects to their own economies. They just
Just to interject, if it is immediately, it is like three months away as such, at the very earliest.
If it is immediately, it will last like 3 days. That's the other thing. if it's immediately like kind of going to turn off the electricity in New York State, okay. it would cut off Alberta's oil exports in the United States. The U.S. will flip the next day. But you know, if you are talking about a sustained level of tariffs as a strategic thing, we're at least 3-6 months away, right? So overnight tariffs are stay overnight.
Thank you. We're out of time today. You've been listening to